How do you do your shopping these days? Do you still go to the supermarket or the department store or market in person, or do you shop online? These days, almost anything is just one click away. It's all very convenient, at least for us. But what about for business? Is it as convenient for them? There'll come a time, people say, when the internet will be invisible. You just won't know about it. It'll be so infiltrated amongst your house, your car, everything you do, that you'll assume it's just a part of life and won't know anything about it. But we have to keep studying it. And Joshua Meltzer has written an article, The Internet, Cross-Border Data Flows and International Trade. Joshua, welcome to the program.
Hi, pleasure to be here.
When I was a kid, the internet hadn't even been heard of. In fact, when I first got into Parliament, it hadn't been heard of, at least not by parliamentarians. And slowly, we've got to the stage where everyone has a computer on the desk, in fact, in their hand, in the form of their phone. So it's a pretty rapid rate of change and having a tremendous impact around the world. What's the main thing you'd like to say about the impact of the net on trade?
Well, I think that the impact is only gradually being realised, and what we're beginning to understand is that the opportunities, if it develops in the appropriate ways and internet access expands globally as it should, that the opportunities there are fairly significant. So what we've begun to see, and this has been going on slowly for a while, but is beginning to build steam as a result of improvements in the internet, and in particular in the expansion of the internet globally outside of not only the developed world but into the developing world, is the capacity for people to use the internet to engage in international transactions that themselves are a form of international trade. And so this is sort of the key, I guess, underpinning of what the internet is doing in terms of trade. The significant thing, of course, is what this is going to mean for, in particular, entrepreneurs, small, medium-sized enterprises, the types of companies and people that have traditionally not been engaged in the international economy, and the opportunities that the internet is going to provide for these new players to now do that.
Yeah. Look, before we get to that, what can you tell us about the disparity, if you like, if that's the way to put it, I'm not sure it is, in the distribution of internet access around the world? You know, if you're living in Australia, you pretty much take it for granted, but there are parts of the world where that wouldn't be the case.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely correct. And the internet, as we know, started in the United States and for most of its life has been largely a developed country phenomenon. So as you say, if you're Australian or American or European, you've been exposed to a lot of internet access. That's also been improving in terms of its speed, and that's an important part of it as we've moved to broadband. So if you look at the United States, for instance, on average, you know, there's 80% of the population and above has got internet access, and these figures are around about the same across the developing world. If you look at the developing world, so let's take Africa broadly, approximately 15% of Africa has access to the internet. If we look at, you know, some of the very large emerging developing countries such as India and China, there's about 1 billion people in India without internet access and close to 750 million people in China without internet access. So still what's significant, what we call sort of the internet divide, the digital divide between the developed and developing world.
Mm. Well, there's an estimate, as I understand it, for every 10% increase in the penetration of broadband services really does something important for your GDP.
That's right. So the internet has a range of ways that it can improve economic growth. And part of that is through the trade channel. Another part is essentially the opportunity of the internet to improve the productivity of economies. And you know, productivity growth is really a key component and driver of economic growth, particularly over time. And essentially what we're talking about here is just the ability to do more with less. And the internet enables this in a whole range of ways, and ways that we'd all be familiar with probably in our everyday lives. So, for instance, we can use Skype to speak to friends, but also if you're a business, you can speak to consumers, you can speak to suppliers at little to no cost. You can use the internet to access computer services in the cloud now. So whereas businesses might have had to in the past have had large sort of standalone permanent IT departments, they can now access both the software and in many respects the hardware in the cloud and scale this up according to business circumstances. They can access cutting edge services over the internet, so whether this is consultancy, financial and the like, which is a key component of allowing businesses to themselves be productive and competitive. So through a variety of these channels, we're seeing this correlation that you initially referred to of improvements in broadband access and economic growth.
Well, your article says that McKinsey Global Institute came up with a study that said that 10% is added to gross domestic product by the net in the last 5 years in the world's top 10 economies. 10% added to GDP. That's enormous.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it also underpins the fact that whereas I think, you know, if you look back to, say, for instance, the 1990s and sort of the beginning of the explosion of the internet, it was very much sort of an IT sector-driven phenomena. Whereas what we're seeing now is that it doesn't really make sense to talk anymore about the internet being something that is confined to a particular sector. Broadly, our entire economies are now, to some extent, digital. I mean, whether you're in, you know, traditional sort of manufacturing industries, whether you're increasingly in a range of service industries from healthcare to telecommunications, whether you're providing services from legal to accounting to design to engineering, you're using the internet in a whole different ways in your business. And so as the internet has expanded and its use across the economy has grown, its impact on economic growth has grown as well. And so we get these figures coming out of McKinsey.
Mm. Well, we look at the sort of things that we understand. Now, the girls, for example, might use the internet. Well, boys, I suppose, as well, to order some makeup. There is one supplier internationally that has great prices for, you know, men's skincare, women's skincare, yada, yada, yada. But it's much more than that simple level of commerce. It is, as you say, the business people who can now access customers and market research, etc. And that leads to the broader point about not trade directly, but the internet and cross-border flow of data. There's a much broader group, for example, researchers, that can be affected by that in a very positive way.
That's right. So in many respects, underpinning the internet, of course, particularly when we talk about the global internet, is connectivity and the ability for data to move freely globally. And this is sort of happening, firstly, there's an infrastructure component to this. So this has been brought about by the build-out of submarine cables between continents. There are terrestrial sort of lines that cross countries. There's some use of satellite, and all these come together to allow internet access to happen globally. That, though, happens because data can move globally. You take a very simple example where you might even be sitting in New York and emailing someone in California, and that email may, in fact, transit through Canada in order to actually get to California. And there's a lot of these examples like that. And so this is partly to do with routing and how the internet infrastructure is set up. But if that data couldn't flow freely, the connectivity, the speeds and the access would be severely undermined.
And there's a number of businesses, because of the internet, enable a very wide range of people in the more developed economies to help others. For example, firms who use the internet to connect investors with small-scale entrepreneurs around the world or in developing countries.
Yeah, that's right. So I think in many respects, you know, there's a lot of potential here for, you know, win-win outcomes, both for businesses and consumers in the developed and developing world. If you look at businesses in the developing world, you know, part of the challenges that they face if they want to engage in the international economy, if they want to access developed country markets, is a whole range of their own domestic barriers. So this might be anything from poor infrastructure, which makes it very costly and difficult to get goods to a port to actually export it overseas. If you're actually a service provider in the developing world, then you know, you've got a lot more difficulties, because really the only way you could possibly deliver that service is either travelling to the developed world, which is itself expensive, or asking people to come and visit you. And as we were talking about it before as well, if you want to be a successful and competitive business, this is true of whether you're situated in Lagos or whether you're situated in Los Angeles, you want to have access to, you know, cost-effective, cutting-edge business services. And we were talking about things like computer and software and other business and professional services, which the internet can provide you access to. So the internet provides now these small businesses in the developing country, increasingly they can access these types of services from across the world to improve their own competitiveness, and then they can use the internet themselves to actually reach customers globally, overcoming a lot of the barriers that they've got locally that have in the past prevented them from engaging in the international economy.
Mm. Now, it's inevitable when something starts up and takes hold and everyone loves it that the regulators step in, and we can see why they have to. There are a range of issues here. There's obviously the privacy and data protection issue, maybe national security. There might be some political restrictions or, as you call them, morality-based internet restrictions. Some commercial ones differing from country to country, you know, which law of contract is going to apply.
Yep.
It's a very messy area, isn't it? How is the world coping at the moment, and how do you suggest we do cope with regulating the complexity of the type of work that is going to be used over the net and the range of countries that the data is going to travel through?
As you, I think, very accurately point out, this is becoming increasingly complex, and, you know, the approach taken, I think, is going to have to be also in its own way fairly multifaceted. For different countries and for different parts of the world, the issues that this increasing use of the internet and its increasing commercial implications are going to create different challenges. And actually, it's probably worth also noting that, I mean, as you point out, when we're talking about political and morality-based restrictions on the internet, we're focused here on the trade and commercial dimensions, but of course, you know, there's a whole variety of other political and sort of informational-based uses of the internet which raise a host of other issues which also call often into a variety of government regulation which can also then have an impact on the commercial and trade dimensions. So, for instance, if we look at the European Union in particular, because I think that's an interesting example at the moment, you know, the issue of how do you regulate privacy is a very key one, and the impact that that has on the internet and cross-border data flows is particularly important. Europe has got a particular approach to privacy, which is somewhat different to the approach that Australia has, and is certainly different to the approach that the United States has taken so far. And this has meant that it has become and will increasingly become potentially more difficult to transfer personal data outside of the EU, which means that it will have certainly impacts on the capacity for the internet to drive trade from the EU into other countries and also from other countries into the EU. Now, the privacy issue is a very difficult one to address because underpinning a lot of the differences in approaches to privacy are historical and cultural differences. So if we go back to Europe, for instance, their experience with World War II and fascism, where access to government records was a key part of how the Nazis carried out their final solution, you know, their response has been a particular one as a result of that. In the US, without that type of history, it's a much more bottom-up approach, which sort of relies essentially on the private sector to put in place the appropriate privacy policies with appropriate government oversight and fines for breach. So there are different models, and reconciling them is going to be a sort of a process of discussion and work and building global norms which recognise the importance of privacy, but trying to do it in ways which doesn't have unnecessary impacts on international trade. In other areas, such as national security, which is becoming increasingly important, and one, as you point out, I think that there's a recognition that this is an important part of it, but following the Snowden incident in the United States, this has become increasingly contentious because it's become clear the extent that, say, for instance, the United States security apparatus, you know, the NSA in particular, was accessing private data in the pursuit of national security goals in ways that other countries claim that they did not realise. And so how do you sort of balance out national security goals, you know, legitimate ones, with privacy and protecting personal data on the internet is going to be, I think, an ongoing discussion going forward. But broadly speaking, another venue where this is being discussed is in the context of trade negotiations because of the trade dimension to it, which we have been talking about. And again, I think part of it is ultimately going to be about getting the appropriate balance right. It's going to be about encouraging a norm which essentially will recognise that the open internet and cross-border data flows should remain the status quo and that deviations from that to achieve other policy goals, whether it's privacy or national security, protecting intellectual property or for other moral reasons, should be allowed but should be done in ways which is, you know, least trade restrictive.
Yeah. Well, we look at the net and we see the great advantages it brings us personally, and we can understand the opportunities for trade and for researchers, for example, to share information around the world. Just key in your subject of research and find out who else is working on this and get in touch with them and share stuff. In a day can be done. What might have in the past taken months and years to find the people doing that sort of work. That's all well and good, but of course then we say, well, no, hold on, I don't want my information out. I want to have limits on who can access this. And we really do. We're a bit Marie Antoinette, aren't we? We want a cake and we want to eat it too.
Yeah, I think that's a great way of putting it. And I think part of it is going to be more information about exactly how data is being put to all these good uses that you were referring to. So, you know, one great, I think, opportunity that is only going to get bigger is going to be this so-called big data, and it's going to be the aggregation of data not only within countries but also globally, which is going to provide, you know, new and expanded data sets which are going to allow researchers to do more detailed sort of epidemiological assessments on diseases. Increasingly, we're seeing this type of data used for security and sort of responding to natural disasters. I mean, for example, when there was the hurricane in the Philippines, in Haiyan, you know, social media was used to overlay that onto a map, and tweets for help and for other calls for water, etc., were used to actually direct emergency services so that was more targeted and delivered more effectively. So that's just one small example. And so understanding this, I think, is going to be part of helping people make decisions about how data is being used. And the other bit is going to be, you know, having in place appropriate privacy frameworks which give, I think, consumers, you know, the confidence that the data will only be used for particular and appropriate purposes.
Mm. What happened in the end with the person who won initially and maybe won finally in the European Court of Human Rights, I think it was, to say they had a right to be forgotten? They could get onto Google and say, you forget me, I want to be taken off.
Yes, I think this is an example of the challenges that countries are dealing with. So the case that you were referring to, there was a Spanish lawyer who had a case against him from approximately 15 years ago relating to a debt issue which had been cleared up. But he was upset that every time he went to Google, this was the first thing that popped up, which led to the case that you referred to. The ultimate result essentially was that Google was required to remove that particular reference to that article from its searches, even though where that article was originally published was still going to remain online. So you couldn't actually necessarily find it that easily using Google, but it was still there. And so the European Court of Justice sort of explained this as trying to find a balance between essentially free speech, which meant that that article would be left online, but also the right to be forgotten, which was to be sort of achieved by requiring Google to take it down from its search results. Now, the crazy thing about this decision, I think, is that it's essentially put Google in the position now where it, in a sense, has become the adjudicator of what is on the internet, or at least what is on the internet when you want to use Google search. And I think it's important to realise that in Europe, Google search accounts for well over 90% of all search. So in many respects, Google is the internet in Europe. And so a private company is now performing this very strange, somewhat public role of trying to determine when a request for a right to be forgotten should actually be allowed or not.
Look, thanks very much for joining us. This is going to be an ongoing issue for some time. We all love to use it every day. We take it for granted. But the poor old legislators are stuck with internationally trying to sort this out. Once again, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Joshua Meltzer is the Fellow in Global Economy and Development at the Brookings Institution and Adjunct Professor at the Johns Hopkins School for Advanced International Studies. His article, The Internet, Cross-Border Data Flows and International Trade, was published by the Asia and the Pacific Policy Studies. You're on RN, and you're listening to Counterpoint with me, Amanda Vanstone.